KPBS On Demand is supported by the Del Mar Wine and Food Festival, October 2nd to 7th. Founded in partnership with Alex Morgan, Drew Brees, and Rob Machado, the festival gathers chefs from San Diego and national TV. A celebration of SoCal culture. Tickets at delmar.wine.
Welcome to KPBS Roundtable. I'm Scott Rodd. San Diego's city council has once again declared a crisis over the lack of shelter for homeless residents. But will a proposed 1,000-bed mega shelter make a difference?
You have to prevent people from becoming homeless. When they become homeless, you have to quickly house them. And you also have to house people who've been on the street for a long time.
Then the San Diego County Board of Supervisors passed a rule to rein in profanity and threats at public meetings. Now it's being challenged in court on First Amendment grounds. Plus, we discuss the Olympics, California wildfires, and other big stories in the roundup. That's just ahead on KPBS Roundtable. In a unanimous vote on Tuesday night, San Diego City Council once again declared a crisis over the lack of shelter for the homeless. This comes on the heels of an hours-long hearing last week about Mayor Todd Gloria's proposal to flip a vacant commercial building into a 1,000-bed mega shelter. But the city's tentative lease for that space is drawing skepticism from some elected officials. The city council's discussion on the mega shelter has been punted to September at the earliest. Here to break down all of this is Blake Nelson, homelessness reporter for the San Diego Union Tribune. Hey, Blake.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And Lisa Halverstadt. She's a senior investigative reporter at Voice of San Diego. Hey, Lisa.
Thanks for having me.
So, Blake, let's start with you. What does it mean for a city to declare a shelter crisis?
Well, it did mean something several years ago when they first did this. It relaxes some health and safety rules that normally apply if you're creating housing or temporary housing. But the original declaration didn't expire. So the vote a few days ago was largely symbolic. It certainly highlights that the city already does not have enough shelter for everybody asking for help, much less everybody sleeping on local streets. And the city is about to lose hundreds of beds for a variety of reasons. So this certainly draws more attention to what is most definitely a crisis, but the council has not yet gone as far as declaring homelessness an emergency or actually changing the law to further reduce some of the regulations surrounding establishing new shelter.
And so if in terms of declaring an emergency, what does that mean? How is that different than what we're what's happening right now?
So the language, San Diego law defines an emergency in a very specific way. And so there would be a lot of legwork would be required to prove that what is happening is an emergency, although I think you can make a compelling case that it is. And so that, especially ahead of the city council recess happening right now in August, that legwork did not happen. But they still could come back to this and declare an emergency later, or they could just change the law and loosen some of the rules that currently apply when setting up new shelters, and that would essentially do the same thing. So this is definitely still on the table for a future meeting.
You had mentioned that there are hundreds of shelter beds that are going to be lost. I do want to get into that. But first, let's talk about the mayor's proposal for this 1,000-bed mega shelter. Lisa, just to start, what's the mayor's vision here?
So the mayor is really envisioning a campus. So right now, the space we're talking about is a warehouse that's about 65,000 square feet. And it's a multi-level building. It's got some outdoor space. And he really wants to make this essentially a few different shelters in one shelter, a 1,000-bed shelter. Now, this would be the largest ever semi-permanent shelter. And I say semi-permanent because right now the lease proposal was for 30 years. As you kind of touched on, we have a lot of shelter beds that are going to be coming offline. And part of the issue is that the city hasn't had long-term control of those properties, or there are different details that make it so they can't be around forever. And so that's one of the selling points that the mayor is making here, is like the city would have control of this property. What he's envisioning is that it would have an array of services on site, you know, medical, dental, behavioral health, And there would be, you know, different areas because this is multi-level and there are sort of different spaces. You would have like about three different areas, one of which would have about 700 beds, a bit more than that, but about 700 beds. I will say, you know, the mayor is really emphasizing that he wants to make this a very inviting space. You know, think about like, you know, artwork and greenery, outdoor space, gathering places. But what I'm hearing a lot from homeless San Diegans and advocates is concern about the large number of beds that are at least initially envisioned for this space.
And how does this fit into the city's overall response to homelessness? Or maybe a different way to put that is, how would this shift the city's response to homelessness if this 1,000-bed shelter was activated?
So, you know, the mayor is really emphasizing that there's a need for shelter beds that the city has control over for a long period of time so that those can be, you know, promised that the city has control. But you know, one thing that I think is always just so important to point out when we're talking about new shelters, if you don't have a housing plan to go along with that, meaning you don't have places that people can go or a plan to get people attached to different subsidies or assistance to get them into housing, shelters can become de facto housing. That's not what we want them to be. A successful shelter or homelessness response that has shelter in it is one that people are flowing through the shelter and getting into housing. And so that's a question, you know, that really I would say, you know, has dominated the discussions too, is like, what is the plan for housing? One of the big, you know, concerns that's come up with this is that the city expects that it would cost about $30 million a year to operate the shelter. Now, that is the equivalent of more than 60% of the city's shelter budget for this current budget year. And the city doesn't have a long-term funding plan for this. And meanwhile, they also, as a city, would be, at least for the initial tenant improvements, would be pulling some money that they could use for permanent housing. And so, you know, the mayor is making the case, you know, we really need a safe haven for people to get off the streets and that the need is just more dire than ever because we're having, you know, shelters that are going to be going offline. A lot of folks who are opposed to this are saying, well, yes, we do think that there's a need for more shelter, but how does this fit into the overarching plan? Are we still going to be making investments in housing? And the mayor will say, yes, absolutely, you know, and will point to the $20 million that they're putting toward permanent housing this year. I think this is something I'm going to be looking to see in that upcoming hearing if this comes back, is there more of a cohesive discussion of what role this plays and what are the other pieces that the city's thinking about? Because, you know, it's not enough to just provide shelter. In order to, like, to kind of come back to that concept I said before, in order to effectively reduce homelessness, you have to do three things. You have to prevent people from becoming homeless. When they become homeless, you have to quickly house them. And you also have to house people who've been on the street for a long time. It's really hard to do those things successfully. So it will be just interesting to see, you know, we've been hearing more conversations about prevention, but also people are spending a lot of time in existing shelters not getting housing.
Blake, one, I want to make sure listeners have a picture in mind of like where this shelter will be. I know it's at the cross street of Kentner and Vine. If you could describe a little bit about where that is and what's around it, but also, you know, a 1,000-bed shelter, that's just massive. Are there other similar shelters in cities around California or around the country?
Yeah, so the property is a little north of the airport. You can easily see the airport and the skyline from there. I walked. I wanted to see how close some trolley stops were. You can walk to one trolley stop in like 6 minutes. Another is like 11 minutes away. It's in the Middletown neighborhood. And proponents have made the case of like there are really not a ton of residential homes or businesses right next to it, although if you walk just a little bit a ways, you can find both of those things. So, but this would be a rare thing in the United States, which is a 1,000-bed shelter. I made a bunch of calls, tried to find every other 1,000-bed shelter I could find in the United States. I could track down five that have at least held 1,000 people at some point in recent years. And a key difference between a lot of those and this property is size. So the property here, the empty warehouse here in San Diego, is about 65,000 square feet. In contrast, there's a campus in Phoenix They have more than 157,600 square feet. You've got Union Rescue Mission in L.A. They've got a five-story structure with 220,000 square feet. And then you've got a sprawling nearly two-dozen-acre campus in San Antonio with about 500,000 square feet. So the other shelters around the country that are holding 1,000 people or more generally have far, far, far more space to work with.
One thing that I think is really important to talk about here, that when we're talking about homelessness or behavioral health, I think doesn't get talked about enough, is it's not just about the facilities. It's about the people who work in them and the supports that you have for people that are coming into these facilities. And I talked to Ann Oliva, who's actually the author of the city's 2019 homelessness plan, who now leads the National Alliance to End Homelessness. And she said, I'm never not going to have concerns about a 1,000-bed shelter, because you just – to have the staffing and the resources there that to meet the need of people there is really challenging, and it can be really costly. And I think it's also really important to point out, you know, often as the mayor is talking about this, he's been bringing up the convention center operation, which at one point did have at its height about 1,300 people staying there. But – back to the staffing thing. At that point, during the, you know, COVID emergency, there were lots of workers at the city and the county, including librarians, who I heard a lot about during this operation, who were repurposed to work at the convention center and were supporting people. So you literally had librarians who were helping homeless people navigate, you know, benefits and other things. And like I said, I heard a lot of great customer service testimonials about the librarians. But that really helped to make that program a success. And right now, we don't have that same sort of situation where folks could be repurposed. Also, there were a lot of additional housing resources that were devoted to helping to get better outcomes for that shelter. And so, you know, yes, the city has, you know, during an emergency, operated a large shelter. But I really don't think that the two situations are as comparable as some would say, because we just can't replicate that COVID emergency shelter today in the same way. We don't have the same resources or emergency abilities.
You had mentioned that this they're looking at a 30-year lease. There are also costs associated with improvements. Is there a price tag, a firm price tag, that's been identified for the mayor's proposal?
I mean, my colleague Jeff McDonald did a breakdown under an earlier version of the lease, and it was over $1 billion.
Over the course of that 30-year period?
Well, at that time it was 35 years. So I think it's definitely safe to say, especially because now the newest annual operating cost estimate is a little bit lower, we're easily talking hundreds of millions of dollars over the next several decades.
And so what's the latest with this project? Why was the city council discussion postponed until at the earliest September?
Well, the city council expressed a lot of concerns. The mayor asked for memos to be submitted laying out concerns that they have and suggestions to improve the lease. The city attorney's office also wanted to firm up some details. And I have to say, you know, during the meeting, it was very clear that it would be very challenging that for them to meet the deadline of Tuesday of this week to get all of that stuff done. So I think what's going to be happening next here is that basically the city's negotiators are going to be going back to the bargaining table with Douglas Hamm, who's the owner of the warehouse that we've been talking about. And trying to see if they can firm up some details, incorporate the feedback from the city council, which was mostly unfavorable on this. And I have checked in with Hamm's team, and what I'm hearing is that he's still in it, at least through September. But I do think there's a question of, is he going to hang on longer than that? It was a very difficult meeting for both Hamm and the city council. The analogy that I've used is it's kind of like, you know, the vibe of that meeting was as if a child had just drawn a picture that they thought was great and gave it to somebody and they threw it on the ground and crumpled it up and said that that sucked. You know, that's really how, when you watch the meeting, I think that's how when Hamm and city staff left the meeting, they were feeling.
So we've been talking a lot about the big players involved in this, the mayor, city council member, city attorney, the owner of the warehouse. But Lisa, you've also spoken with people experiencing homelessness about their perspective on this mega shelter. What did they have to say about this 1,000-bed mega shelter at this location?
There are a lot of concerns about 1,000 beds. That's getting the most attention. There's a lot of concern about, you know, whether that would be safe. There's concern about could illnesses spread, in such a large facility. I'm hearing concerns about people feeling like it's kind of an institution, you know, a la a prison. And is that really a place they're going to feel comfortable? I'm hearing a lot of the concerns that I hear about all sorts of congregate shelters, too, of, you know, when you bring that many people together, somebody and multiple somebodies are going to be having a bad day. That's just how it works. And so you bring all those people together and, you know, is this going to be an environment that people can feel safe in? You know, I say often, I am not somebody that could go into congregate shelter because I would never sleep. I'm a light sleeper. There's also always going to be somebody who's snoring. You know, it's just when you get even just a few dozen people together, I guarantee you, you're going to get a loud snorer. So there's just a lot of concerns about bringing that many people together. And also, is this going to be a real solution? Going back to what I was talking about before in terms of what you need to effectively reduce homelessness and the need to have the housing plan tied to this. A lot of people are concerned that like, okay, so if I take a chance and go to the shelter, am I actually going to get housing or is this just, you know, designed to just hide me? You know, basically get me off the street so people don't have to look at me. So I think there are a lot of concerns about this. There are some people that are excited about the prospect of a shelter, but those people tend to be folks who are already in a shelter. Really, the top line that I'm hearing from almost everybody is 1,000 beds? Ooh.
And Blake, let's talk about the impact on other shelters or safe sleeping sites. You mentioned that it looks like there is going to be a loss of hundreds of shelter beds. What impact would this shelter have on the, you know, shelter picture more broadly in San Diego?
So in a perfect world, it would both boost the number of available shelter spots for the very large numbers of people who are asking for shelter every night. And in a perfect world, it would also reduce pressure on all of these existing facilities, which are pretty much at capacity, more or less over and over and over. The danger is that something like this could end up pulling money away from other programs that are already serving people right now. The most recent estimate from city officials is San Diego is going to lose access to 732 shelter beds by January. There's two footnotes to sort of attach onto that. One is a big chunk of that loss is the Paul Mirable Center that Father Joe's runs downtown a few blocks east of Petco Park. That is going to stop being a traditional homeless shelter, but it is going to become a detox and sober living facility for homeless residents. So even though it will not technically be within the city system, it's not like those spots are just disappearing for people that need it. The other thing is the 732 number doesn't count a bunch of other facilities and programs that are eventually scheduled to disappear, but we just don't know exactly when they're going to go away. That includes both designated camping areas, the safe sleeping sites by Balboa Park. Those may be expanded in the next few months, but their permits are temporary. Neither are viewed as super long-term solutions. You've got Alpha Project's tent downtown at 16th and Newton. That land eventually needs to become a new development, but there have been some hang-ups in the development process, so we don't know when that's disappearing. So there are a lot of moving parts, which again is what some proponents of the Kettner and Vine shelter keep coming back to, is if we had this one big thing that would just sit here for several decades, this would be nicer than all of these moving parts we've got right now.
So I think one thing that's really crucial to point out when we're thinking about these shelters going offline is the timeline for Kettner and Vine to open, or Hope at Vine to open.
Yeah.
And the latest estimate, which came when they were discussing as a city council whether to approve this, was June 2025. So I think we all probably have to consider that since this didn't get voted on, that's probably pushed back by at least a few months now. So it's not as if, you know, one day You're going to close these other shelters and you immediately have this 1,000-bed shelter. And when these shelters open up too, they tend to ramp up. So I know the city's initially envisioning maybe they'd open up 100 beds to start, kind of get a feel for how that's working, work on hiring more staff. So there's still a big problem that the city has to solve. By the end of this year, they really have to figure out what is going to happen to all the people that are now in these existing beds, or saying they're going to find places for them to go. And are they going to be able to replace these sites? Like, one of the other shelters that has to shut down is Golden Hall, which is in the City Hall complex. You know, that's, you know, 250-plus beds right now that are going to be going offline by the end of the year, probably sooner. So there's some push now, too, to try to come up with a plan, you know, even before Kettner and Vine would open, you know, for where these beds are going to be relocated. And it's unclear that the city is going to be able to deliver new places for people to go.
Let's take a step back and look at some of the impacts of what's happening at a statewide and national level. You have the U.S. Supreme Court recently ruling that camping bans are, in fact, legal. You have Governor Gavin Newsom recently issuing an executive order that urged state agencies to move quickly, move urgently to address encampments on state agency land. But also the order urged local governments to take similar actions to address encampments. So we're talking about all of this complexity with shelter space, but now also there's potentially going to be clearing of encampments. So how does that factor into this very complex picture around sheltering homeless people?
I don't see any major shift in the city of San Diego. Where we may see more of a shift in enforcement is several other cities around in the county. So my colleagues and I called a bunch of mayors after the U.S. Supreme Court basically made it easier for cities to clear encampments. They took away a requirement that you had to be able to offer some sort of shelter if you're going to kick someone off from sleeping on public property. And so several mayors, including in Escondido and in Chula Vista, have expressed openness at being more aggressive in clearing encampments. We might see proposed camping ban be resurrected in National City, but all of that is still just speculative at this point. There hasn't been a lot of hard movement, except San Marcos passed a camping ban. Yeah. But at this point, my understanding is just a lot of cities are exploring more aggressive enforcement. And that's probably where we'll see changes.
What will be interesting to see is, do these cities that are exploring more enforcement also explore more shelter options? A lot of those that are now starting to talk about this more don't have shelter to directly offer. And I think that, you know, really the Grants Pass decision in my mind is much more impactful than the governor's directive. You know, maybe that just puts a little bit more pressure on and maybe gives some folks some like political ammunition to go forward with and move forward with something like a camping ban or clear encampments. But really, it's the Supreme Court decision that even that executive order was based on, is now you've got this directive, you know, from, you know, or at least you've gotten a change in terms of what cities have to do in order to proceed with enforcement. They don't necessarily have to have shelter. Now, Mayor Gloria has said again and again that he still thinks it's important to provide shelter. And I know he'd love for me to say on here right now that, man, maybe this will get other cities to step up on shelter. But that's still to be seen.
Homelessness, a huge topic for many San Diegans, many Californians. We could keep this conversation going for a long time, but we'll have to wrap it there. I've been speaking with Blake Nelson, homelessness reporter for the San Diego Union-Tribune. Thanks for joining us, Blake.
Thanks for having me.
And Lisa Halverstadt, senior investigative reporter for Voice of San Diego. Thanks, Lisa.
Thanks so much for having me.
When Roundtable returns, the San Diego County Board of Supervisors passed a rule to rein in profanity and threats at public meetings, but free speech proponents filed a lawsuit over it.
I think it's a textbook case of how difficult it is to bring some order to these meetings, which have just been filled with a lot of cussing, just a lot of rudeness.
That's just ahead on Roundtable.
Hello, this is Dr. Michael Lalage, Medical Director and Chief of Staff for Kaiser Permanente San Diego. For more than 50 years, San Diegans have entrusted their health care to us. Our care and coverage connect to provide medical care tailored to each member. With our integrated network of primary and specialty care, we work together using evidence-based medicine to help deliver positive results. We believe in a healthy and engaged life with good beginnings and dignified endings. We believe that life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness requires total health, including equal access to high-quality, affordable health care. At Kaiser Permanente, our cause is health. Our passion is service. We work to help make lives better. To learn more, visit kp.org/San Diego.
You're listening to KPBS Roundtable. I'm Scott Rodd. Public participation in local government meetings has grown increasingly uncivil in recent years. A KPBS investigation last month analyzed this alarming trend at San Diego County Board of Supervisor meetings. It documented how threats, profanity, and racist remarks directed at local leaders are all on the rise. In late 2022, the Board of Supervisors passed a new rule meant to curb harassment and discriminatory comments. Now that rule is being challenged in court on First Amendment grounds. Here to talk about this story is KPBS investigative reporter Amitha Sharma. Welcome back to Roundtable.
It's good to be here, Scott.
So we had you on the show last month to talk about your in-depth investigation that examined incivility at County Board of Supervisor meetings. Briefly, remind us what you found.
So, Scott, we did a review of public comments from a three-month sample spanning certain years between 2009 and 2023. We paid really close attention to the years following COVID to detect exactly when incivility rose. And sure enough, we found that people became less civil about a year into the pandemic. For example, in 2009, KPBS found that there were just two incidents of incivility. And then in 2023, we found that there were 167 such incidents of incivility. And so when we say incivility, we're talking about offensive language, we're talking about making threats, we're talking about making allegations against supervisors without any kind of evidence. We're talking about parroting conspiracies.
Nearly 2 years ago, right in the heart of what you're talking about in terms of the rise of incivility, the Board of Supervisors decided to impose new rules for public comment at their meetings. What changes did they make?
They made some small changes, but there were changes that they believed would have a real effect. So they cut the time that public commenters could speak if there were 10 or more speakers. And if those comments turned disorderly, the chairperson reserved the right to pause the meeting and possibly have the disruptive person removed. The issue, I believe, is in the details. The part of the change in the county's rules that allows the chairperson to reprimand and possibly remove a disruptive commenter states that basically that can happen if the chairperson of the board deems those comments discriminatory or harassing.
So it sounds pretty subjective then. It's leaving a lot of discretion up to the chair.
It absolutely is. It's arbitrary.
So did that new rule have any effect on profanity, threats, and offensive speech at these public meetings?
We didn't specifically set out to determine that. But what I can tell you is that that change took effect in November 2022. And for the three-month period we looked at, from October of 2022 through December of that year, there were 132 incidents of incivility. And then next year, last year, in 2023, there were 167 incidents. So it seems that not only did incivility not go down, it actually rose.
Very interesting. And so now that rule is being challenged in court. Who filed this lawsuit and what's their argument?
So local lawyer Corey Briggs filed the lawsuit on behalf of Project for Open Government, who says its mission is government accountability. Briggs says the problem with the county's rule change on public comments is the way it defines discriminatory or harassing remarks. He says it just simply doesn't jibe with the First Amendment. The county says Discriminatory or harassing statements can include, and I'm quoting directly from their document, legally protected speech in a board meeting that disparages an individual or a group based on their perceived race, religion, sexual orientation, ethnicity, gender, disability, or other hate speech, but does not rise to the level of a criminal threat or inciting violence. And again, the county itself is saying that discriminatory or harassing remarks can include legally protected speech.
Very interesting. Have you heard from any members of the public or folks who go to these meetings in response to the new rules that the Board of Supervisors put in place?
Well, I can tell you that in the course of my reporting for the three-part incivility series, the members of the public who have often been called out for being rude told me that they felt like the Board of Supervisors were trampling on their free speech rights.
Interesting. And so you spoke to some experts on civics and free speech. What did they have to say about this new rule?
Well, I spoke to David Loy of the First Amendment Coalition, and I spoke with Erwin Shemerinsky, who is the dean of the UC Berkeley Law School. Neither of them spoke on the lawsuit per se. They spoke in very broad terms about the challenges that government officials face in trying to restrict offensive comments at public meetings. So Erwin Shemerinsky says, look, government officials can remove a person from a meeting if they're being disruptive, if they are speaking beyond their allotted time, or they're yelling over other people who have the floor. He says they cannot impose a civility code. They can't bar people from cussing, and they can't stop people from using racial or ethnic slurs.
Where does the lawsuit stand right now? What's next?
So I think they're in discovery right now. It could, if the case doesn't get settled before then, it could go to trial before the end of this year.
Wow. And so let's take a step back. What does this situation say more broadly about the challenges of trying to curb profanity and threats at public meetings while also trying to respect free speech?
Well, I think it's a textbook case of how difficult it is to bring some order to these meetings, which have just been filled with a lot of cussing, just a lot of rudeness, and have left a lot of people not feeling so great. As Shemerinsky said, you get to use racial or ethnic slurs. You even get to swear at your elected officials, and you get to make allegations without presenting evidence. The fine line is that you don't get to incite violence, and you don't get to make explicit threats. What I can say is that all of the experts I spoke to on incivility uniformly said that elected officials and the public who isn't behaving this way aren't without their own tools. Elected officials can call out the behavior and say, hey, look, we don't agree with what's being said. We don't condone what's being said. We believe that what's being said represents a minority of our community. And the experts also said that the onus is on the public, that more people, more members of the public, while it may be unpleasant to attend these meetings, must go to these meetings, and they must speak there in larger numbers.
Right. So that perspective being the answer is more speech, so to speak, to combat the profane, uncivil speech. So as we wrap up here, from your perspective, you've been deep in this now for months and reviewing this, talking to experts, listening in on so many public meetings. Where do you see this going from here? Do you think that it can work itself out if there's more public input and sort of public pressure to have a more civil discourse at this public meetings?
Well, I think that there are phases to how society behaves, you know, what becomes the norm for a while. I think that, you know, there have been other periods in our history where people were a little bit more rude and then things tamped down, as you and I both know and as we've discussed in the newsroom. We're well aware of what's going on at the national level when it comes to politics. And I think a lot of the language that we hear at the national level seeps in to the local discourse. I think if that ever turns around, this will turn around too, short of, you know, the public taking matters into its own hands and really attending these meetings in droves and really speaking out. I think if they don't, it might go away on its own.
I guess we'll just have to wait and see. I've been speaking with KPBS investigative reporter Amitha Sharma. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Scott.
When we come back, we discuss an international prisoner swap, California wildfires, and San Diego athletes competing in the Olympics.
Beyond skating, you know, there's a couple surfers too. Katie Simmer, she's from Oceanside, also participating, but on the other side of the world, in French Polynesia. So it's cool to see that skating-surfing connection, which San Diego is so well known for.
That's next on Roundtable.
Hello, this is Dr. Michael Lalich, Medical Director and Chief of Staff for Kaiser Permanente San Diego. For more than 50 years, San Diegans have entrusted their health care to us. Our care and coverage connect to provide medical care tailored to each member. With our integrated network of primary and specialty care, we work together using evidence-based medicine to help deliver positive results. We believe in a healthy and engaged life with good beginnings and dignified endings. We believe that life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness requires total health, including equal access to high-quality, affordable health care. At Kaiser Permanente, our cause is health. Our passion is service. We work to help make lives better. To learn more, visit kp.org/San Diego.
You're listening to KPBS Roundtable. I'm Scott Rodd. It's time for our weekly roundup, where we discuss some stories, big and small, that caught our attention this week. Joining me is Jacob Ayer, reporter and producer at KPBS. Hey, Jacob.
Hey, Scott.
All right, so start us off. What have you been reading and watching this week?
In terms of watching, like most people, the Olympics is what I've been focused on, especially because we have a lot of different athletes from here in San Diego County who are participating.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, we have a Jagger Eaton. He won silver in the skateboarding park event. So he was born in Arizona, but he's been living in Encinitas now, I think, for something like 5 or 6 years. He's well known in the San Diego skateboarding scene. I don't know if you caught any of the park's skateboarding, but I mean, it's incredible what these guys are doing.
Oh, yeah, it's amazing. And beyond just Jagger, there were a ton of athletes who are participating both on the men's and women's for skateboarding that, you know, have ties to San Diego County. We earlier on KPBS Midday Edition actually had one of them on. It was just, it's so cool to see how action sports really in San Diego County have these really deep ties.
Yeah, well, actually, I was able to meet the skateboarding team, the men's and the women's, a few weeks ago. I sort of strong-armed my way into this story. Another reporter here was also covering it. I was able to go out and join him. And it was awesome to meet them. I mean, they were all so psyched to be going to Paris. A lot of younger skateboarders, you know, some, especially on the women's side, in their teens, which is like incredible to see. But then also some older sort of older states folks of the skateboarding scene as well, like Nyjah Houston. So it was really cool to see that. And on the men's and women's side, the level of technical ability is just incredible. I don't know if you skateboarded growing up. I did. I played Tony Hawk Pro Skateboarder all the time. Some of the stuff they're doing now is stuff that, like, I figured you could only do in a video game.
It's beyond that, honestly, some of it. Some of the different rides or tricks that they're doing weren't even possible in video games 10, 15 years ago. It's that good. And we were actually able to talk to one of the skaters, Bryce Wettstein. She was fantastic to talk to and just listen to that conversation. But beyond skating, you know, there's a couple surfers, too. Katie Simmer, she's from Oceanside, also participating. But on the other side of the world, in French Polynesia. So it's cool to see that skating-surfing connection, which San Diego is so well known for.
Absolutely. And the wave, Teahupo, out in French Polynesia, it's really picked up on some of these days. I mean, you're seeing some sets that are coming in at 10, 12 feet, and it's like staggering to see them go up against this wave, you know, gliding above a foot or two of water above a dry reef. It's like just mind-boggling.
Yeah. And, you know, outside of the typical skating and surfing, there are other athletes here from San Diego. Kelsey Plum from Poway. She's currently going for her second gold with the U.S. women's basketball team. That's something to watch. I mean, she's a big name in the basketball world as a whole outside of the Olympics. And like I said, you know, outside of skating and surfing, there's just a ton of different athletes. There was even a rower that we talked to previously on KPBS. Tons to tune into.
Absolutely. Has there been any event or moment beyond the San Diego representation of the games that caught your attention?
I mean, Simone Biles. I think that's the one that pretty much everyone has been talking about. Just her being able to come back and then getting that Olympic individual all-around final title after just 2 days later from getting the women's team back to that gold medal. I think she's really put the nation on her back and was able to work through that pressure.
It's been incredible seeing her. I mean, again, similar to like the technical ability on the skateboarding side, seeing what the gymnasts are doing is just mind-boggling. All right, we could talk about Olympics all day, but let's switch gears. This story, you know, was a sigh of relief, I think, for everyone in the U.S., but also especially in the journalism world. Wall Street Journal reporter Evan Gershkovich was released from a Russian prison. You know, he was imprisoned for 16 months under, you know, as the U.S. is saying, and he has adamantly put forward his false allegation that he was working on behalf of the government. I mean, he is a reporter for the Wall Street Journal. This was part of a massive prisoner swap involving seven different countries, 24 different prisoners. The complicated nature behind it's kind of wild, but Evan Gershkovich is really the name that many people have been focused on.
It's scary. I mean, thinking about the fact that, you know, working in the media industry, seeing this happening for Gershkovich, just terrifying. But, you know, thinking about freedom of press around the world, concerning to say the least.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Russia is known as a country where there are not friendly laws as it relates to press freedom, but something like this hasn't happened in a long time in terms of clamping down, imprisoning a reporter who's just out there working for a major news outlet, just doing their job. You know, I read some of the specifics of how Gershkovich passed the time while in this pretty infamous Russian prison. He read War and Peace. He was playing chess move by move with his father through the mail. Each time they exchanged a letter, they would move a piece. And it just seems like he had such fortitude to get through this imprisonment. Just really so happy to see that this reporter has been released and is now back home.
Outside of, you know, the terrifying ordeal there, there is some local stuff here in the state that's also concerning, thinking about what's happening on the environmental side, the park fire up in the northern part of the state. This is on verge of becoming the fourth largest fire now in California history. And we even have some local fire departments going up there to help out.
Yeah, I believe Chula Vista sent some firefighters. This is a massive blaze. You have 6,000 personnel that are fighting this thing. It's in an area that has parts of this area in Butte County and Tehama County have burned before. It's not far from where the campfire destroyed most of the town of Paradise and killed more than 80 people. And just the speed at which this thing took off and has expanded, as you said, to one of the biggest in state history is terrifying. And it reflects, you know, the state of extreme heat in the state right now, the dry vegetation, and gives a lot of people concern about what may come, you know, in the rest of this fire season. We're only now just in August, and a lot of times the biggest fires don't happen until later in the summer and even into the fall.
Well, exactly. That's what I was going to say. I mean, this is early August. We have another two-ish months, maybe a little bit more
maybe
fire
three
season.
Months, yeah.
3 months. So, you know, hopefully that this is the worst of what we're going to see this year. But even here locally, just outside of San Diego, the Nixon fire was kind of dotting the county line. It was around 5,000 acres. So we'll see if, you know, there's going to be a larger statewide impact beyond just the park fire. And then maybe there'll be potentially more impactful fires here locally.
We'll see. I mean, fingers crossed that it doesn't happen. But we've been having extreme heat here in San Diego County, in East County, over into Imperial. So hopefully we don't see fires that are that ferocious spark around here. Okay, what else have you been reading this week?
I think just looking around, looking at, you know, always thinking about housing prices. For the first time in 6 months, San Diego is no longer the number one metro with the fastest growing home prices, which is, I think, a good thing. Now that's New York. Like I was saying, San Diego had that mark for 6 months. But The pace of home growth is starting to slow down for most markets, and that does include San Diego.
Yeah, but we are still number two. Is that correct?
Two. That's right.
So not a whole lot of relief for folks. You know, what the median resale for a single-family home in San Diego in the metro area was, you know, like $1 million in May, right? So it's still, I mean, if you're talking about, you know, folks trying to get into the housing market for the first time, man, is that
impossible for most.
Yeah, I sort of am speaking from personal experience here as someone who would like to, in the near-term horizon, you know, get a home after getting married. It's a daunting prospect.
Right, yeah, it can feel almost impossible at points. But I think silver lining, we're no longer at the top. We'll see if what happens in coming months.
Yeah, we will see. So sticking with real estate, bopping over to New York City, there's this office building that was up for sale back in 2006. This, you know, large office building sold for over $300 million. It just sold again. Can you guess how much it sold for?
And this is how many stories?
I'll just say it's pretty big. It's a big office building in Midtown Manhattan.
I would say hundreds of millions, something like that.
Less than $9 million.
Wow.
So the reason is this building is mostly empty now because it's just, you know, office tenants in New York, but also in cities around the country are just, you know, emptying out of these buildings. And, you know, commercial real estate has really taken a hit following the pandemic. More and more workers are working from home or working hybrid, remote. And you just have these office tenants that are clearing out of these buildings. And so, you know, it's stunning to see. I think this is maybe somewhat of an outlier, maybe, of just how dramatic of a price reduction, this building sold for. But the trend is happening in cities across the country.
Right. And in San Diego here, there are empty buildings downtown. We'll see, you know, if this is a larger issue that plays out locally here, just with, you know, you have a housing crisis and then you have these empty buildings downtown. It does kind of present this weird juxtaposition.
Absolutely. And I think there's a lot of hand-wringing over what are we going to do with this space? How are we going to activate the downtown area here in San Diego, but elsewhere as well? If you don't have workers there, if some of these office buildings are empty or partially empty, what are we going to do with them? What's an alternative? I think there are a lot of people scratching their head trying to come up with creative solutions. All right. That's all the time we have. Jacob Ayer, thanks for joining us on the Roundup.
Thanks so much, Scott.
That's our show for today. You can listen to KPBS Roundtable anytime as a podcast. KPBS Roundtable airs on KPBS-FM at noon on Fridays and again Sundays at 6 a.m. If you have any thoughts on today's show or ideas for a future one, you can email us at roundtable@kpbs.org. You can also leave us a message at 619-452-0228. Roundtable's technical producers this week were Brendan Trufa and Ben Redlosk. This show was produced by Jacob Ayer. Brooke Ruth is Roundtable's senior producer, and I'm Scott Rodd. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.
KPBS On Demand is supported by the San Diego County Toyota Dealers. Experience the new 2024 Tundra, designed to combine performance and comfort with a 12,000-pound towing capacity and 10-speed automatic transmission. See your Toyota dealer for more. San Diego County Toyota Dealers. We make it easy.